China 21 is produced by the 21st Century China Center at UC San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. We are a university-based think tank that produces original research to anchor major policy discussions on China and its relationship to the United States. This podcast features expert voices, insights, and stories about Chinese economy, politics, society, and the implications for international affairs. Learn more at china.ucsd.edu.
Hello, all. Welcome to another episode of 21st Century China Center podcast from the School of Global Policy and Strategy at UC San Diego. Today, we will talk about the potential trade conflict between China and the United States. I'm Victor Xi, an expert of China's politics at UCSD. Today with us are two leading experts to help us understand the potential trade conflict. First, we have Natalia Raimondo, who is a leading expert in multinational production, so very timely here, and the economics of trade. And of course, we also have Barry Naughton, who has been studying China's economy, working with China's top economists for decades, and literally wrote the textbook on China's economy. So we're going to start with some more general issues. Natalia, the classical theories of trade tend to assume that small open economies are trading. But here in this situation, we have two of the largest economies of the world potentially imposing tariffs on just each other, but not on anyone else. What does the literature and the research tell us would be the welfare consequences and its effect on global trade?
Yes, so the classic model of for large economies of like when a country imposes tariffs will tell us that, well, maybe if the country is large and if there is not repeated interaction, the country might gain from doing that. Always the producers have a surplus, consumers have a loss, and in net, in general, there are losses for a big country because we have these terms of trade effects. There are potentials because they move international prices. There are potentials for gains.
So it's like a monopolist.
Yeah. But the thing is that here we are like on a repeated game kind of stage. So it's not that the big country like the U.S. do whatever they want and then nobody's going to respond. There is the other big country that retaliates and then a trade war might start. And we know also that in these repeated interactions, I mean, it's the classical example why we needed multilateralism in the first place. And like the two economies or the world as a whole will end up in a worse place.
So basically, other countries besides China will stop trusting the United States to not impose tariffs on them down the road. Is that the fear
here?
Maybe.
Yeah. We see two different cases, right? With the steel and aluminum, where it was like all across the board, and then start negotiating bilaterally. And here we see just picking the bilateral partner that they wanna raise tariffs on.
Yeah, I think the Trump administration, I guess, realized that across the board was not such a great thing, and they walked back from that, obviously. So the other general issue, which is more closer to, you know, obviously a lot of your research, is that it looks like from the tariff list from the U.S. is that it's mainly filled with intermediate goods like industrial chemicals, boilers, steel products, aircraft engines, while the Chinese list, if China were to implement the list, has a number of final goods such as nuts and fruits and wines and cars. How does that affect who, you know, if the two sides were to impose these tariffs, how does it affect who is going to win, quote unquote, as in suffer less welfare consequences from these tariffs in the event of a trade war?
So, Victor, here is very important to say that the global value chain, that is farms like deciding to split production among many locations, China among them, and not only American farms, but Japanese farms, Korean farms, is very important. And it might change completely our understanding of what I just said about what we know from tariffs. So think about American farms that need these inputs from their affiliates or licensed firms in China. Like Apple is a very good example, right? Foxconn produces in China, the parts of the iPhone that then is shipped back to the US. I mean, I'm giving an example. We need to see the list that is all over the place, product by product. But that has potential, I mean, I'm sure, that to disrupt the production processes because many firms won't get these intermediate specialized inputs that they're themselves or somebody for them produce in China. And it's not only, I mean, I guess like maybe Japanese firms might be worried because they use China and other Asian countries as a base to ship goods to the US that maybe are, or to their affiliates in the US. Think about like Toyota, they have affiliates producing cars in the US, but they get some suppliers from Japan or from their China affiliates. And we have studies that show that this global value chain is very rigid. Substitution with the cost increase.
This chemical, then the U.S. producer is going to be put at a big disadvantage because now when it imports this Chinese chemical, it's going to have to pay another 20% more.
Exactly.
Whereas its Japanese competitor would not have to pay this 20% extra, and that would hurt U.S. businesses. And indeed, that's what some of these businesses have complained about, obviously, to the Trump administration and also to the media. So you're saying this is the case when there is not easy substitutes to be found for these Chinese goods?
Yeah, for instance, especially if it's the same firm. If it's like the U.S., the chemical affiliate in China and shipping back to the parent in the U.S., that we know that is very, very difficult to substitute. We can think of licensing cases. We don't see it in ownership, but more difficult to capture in the data, but still, it's kind of the same phenomenon or the same rigidity. So the other thing that we should say here that is because of the global value chain and its complexity, the $100 of the chemical input that come into the U.S. might not be 100% produced in China. Like the example, the archetypical example is the iPhone, that we know that only 4% of the value was added in China. So the $100 that come in the U.S. only like 4% is Chinese. So now we are putting tariffs on the $100 instead of the $4. So that's, again, we need to analyze trade like what is called in value-added terms and not in gross terms because it can be very different.
And I think, Natalia, your perspective helps explain something that would otherwise be very peculiar, which is the amount of tariffs in the context of the global economy so far is rather small, but the stock market response to every indication that the trade war is heating up has been huge. I mean, we've seen days in the market where $1 trillion worth of value is destroyed because of the fears of a trade war. And so I think your perspective makes clear that what companies are worried about is having to reinvest in whole sections of the value chain that could be extremely expensive.
It's very sunk cost intensive. So you don't build a $2 billion plan with 4,000 employees one day to the other. Like Intel has these big monster plans. When they decided to install it in one place, they stay there for many years. So it's not, as Barry said, it's really difficult to reallocate the global value chain.
But it does happen.
It happens.
It happens.
It happens. You can buy firms. You can sell them. I mean, you can close them. It happens. But it's only very big players can do it very quick.
Right. And well, so in a way, this is kind of, I don't know if it's a problem, but if the U.S. is playing these short-term games, you know, where it threatens to impose tariffs on this and that kind of product, instead of saying that, you know, we are going to impose this tariff and it's going to be effective for the next 10 years, that's almost better in some sense. It helps people to relocate the production in some sense, right? Can you say that?
Yeah. I think maybe.
Maybe, yeah, I know. I'm not an expert, so I don't pretend. So shifting over to Barry a little bit here. In the Section 301 report authored by USTR, the U.S. details a large number of Chinese practices in order to realize tech transfers, you know, from U.S. companies to Chinese companies, as well as China's practice of heavily subsidizing and protecting domestic producers. So you've worked with Chinese economists for a number of years. But I think the English literature and Chinese economists and discussion has tended to focus on the market-friendly, oriented economists. Was there always a group of economists who have studied the benefits of state subsidies and the benefits of protectionism? Because there is kind of this literature on this, right? And you don't have to name names, but I just wonder, what were some of the main conclusions drawn by, if such a group exists, what were some of the main conclusions drawn by these sort of state economists who study kind of state behaviors and strategic behavior, if you will?
Well, there isn't what I would consider to be really good empirical literature on the costs and benefits of these kinds of policies. But there's definitely a camp that advocates in a strong industrial policy in China. And so, of course, in broader Asia, this is one of the ironic things going on right now, that Japan and Korea, having pretty much decided that they had grown out of any need for industrial policy, have pretty much abandoned it and stopped talking about it. And now, all of a sudden, China has ramped up both the discussion and the expenditure of resources. There's a real problem in this from an academic perspective, though, which is that China's devotion to people think of China as having always had a strong interventionist state. But actually, the reality is the intervention on this scale is just something that's been going on for less than 5 years. It really dates from strategic emerging industries, which were articulated in 2010, and then the Made in China and Internet Plus programs just in the last couple of years. So it's all very new. We've never seen a commitment of resources on
this
scale.
You wouldn't see the Zhao Ziyang document in 1988 as a strategic document?
No, absolutely not.
But it's an interesting point. You say that internally they haven't had a chance to evaluate the effectiveness of their own kind of industrial policies. I find that unlikely, but
there was an evaluation of technology policies in general that took place about 4 years ago, after the administration shifted from Wen Jiabao to Li Keqiang. And they concluded, and it's never been publicized, so we don't know exactly what they said, but they concluded that they hadn't worked very well in the past. But their response was to essentially redouble the efforts. So, I don't think there's a good basis for it. And it's a kind of blind man touching the elephant sort of thing. They might point to solar panels as an example of success. But solar panels was a case where a lot of money was invested.
Sure.
Yes, China occupies the world market, but it produces, very, very low price, medium sophisticated goods. It's not clear that the advantage to the Chinese economy of, having a dominant position in the global market for solar panels is really any kind of significant benefit. But at the same time, it disrupted the global industrial development process. Now, of course, it had benefits for consumers, so it's not a totally bad thing. But, American homeowners gained probably more of the benefits from that policy than did Chinese companies. This is also why I think we're in a little bit of a strange position right now, because the administration is trying to get China to abandon its industrial policies. This is not going to happen. And in fact, I think it's counterproductive. We don't know for sure that this is true, but there have been news reports in Bloomberg and the Wall Street Journal saying that what the United States has basically been asking for China is that it abandon Made in China 2025. I think the basic Chinese response to this is going to be, this policy must be working because the Americans are spooked. Therefore, we should continue it. And that's not really what we should be doing, and it's not really, I think, a very effective strategy. Because what we should be doing is saying, look, if you want to spend money on emerging technologies, that's your business, that's fine. The point is, if you're going to create healthy industries with a global presence, then you have to do it in a way that follows sort of fair guidelines so that these industries can compete and prevail. And if that happens, a lot of Chinese industries will compete and prevail.
The subsidies, isn't the literature saying the subsidies actually does provide big advantages to producers potentially, right?
Well, potentially. We don't have like ultimate evidence, but with respect to R&D policies, for instance, in China. So I have a PhD student now that he's Chinese. He's investigating if the big human capital shock actually from the end of the 90s has something to do with the rise in R&D apart from all the policies. So if that alone created the big increase in R&D, and then from there, like, going global.
So just a lot of Chinese students who received degrees overseas going back to China?
No, it's more like in 1999 there was this policy that basically increased enrollment in colleges. The quotas were like increased by 8 times.
Yeah.
And during the next 5 years, you see like this trend of very skilled people going to the market. And they went to firms that became very, very skill intensive and R&D intensive. So what's the causality? Is this human capital shock, as we call it, the cause of how much of the R&D
R&D and also maybe Chinese companies taking over production in certain sectors?
In certain sectors that are more high skill and so on. So that's very important. But that's one thing that I think nobody has to tell China what to do, not on that or industrial policies. Then there are international rules that if you want to play on the international arena and you're part of the WTO, well, you might get these cases. Like this one is kind of how the case started, right?
Although that's like, consistent with the technology theft story also, because you need human capital to make use of stolen technology,
you have to understand the blueprints. And maybe that's the reason why some academic papers make calculations and say like China received much less FDI than they should have because of these joint venture requirements.
Right.
That I think they realized at some point that they weren't very successful. They scaled down and maybe now they're going back again. But I mean, we know that deters entry into China of foreign firms. I mean. But again, if you play on the WTO, we need to respect those the treaties, TRIPS, basically. And I can see other countries like Japan and the EU and the US like filing the complaint at the WTO.
So if the main US complaint really, and it seems to be the case in Section 301 report, is to prevent the unfair or involuntary transfer of technology from the U.S. To Chinese companies. Besides imposing tariffs, which clearly a lot of people say that's not really the way to go in terms of deterring that kind of behavior, what do you think would be effective policies, on the part of the U.S., if any, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, the U.S., it's like, it has a comparative advantage in innovation. I mean, like, it happened in the last 30 years for sure. I mean, like, all this tariff story and all the rhetoric of the administration is like, we want the U.S. to go back to be a manufacturing hub, like it or not. But that's not what the U.S. is now.
It's good at, yeah.
It's good at. So
more spending on basic science research or something like that?
For instance, yes, like, keep doing what they were doing. Yeah,
instead of cutting off the funding from the NSF.
Like, the big advantage of U.S. firms is like all these, we call it managerial ability, managerial capital, and the intangible capital. I mean, like, it's very valuable to be Coca-Cola because you have that intangible capital, and that's what the U.S. has been good at and invented the iPhone, etc. And I think they should keep doing that.
Keep doing that.
Being the innovator hub, not
distorting the market in some way.
And try to become again a manufacturing hub. That's not going to happen. That's the wrong counterfactual in some sense.
Yeah, Barry? Yeah, what do you think?
Before we discuss further that point, I certainly agree with the need to invest more in science and research in the United States, especially in sort of non-medical areas. We do fine in medical things, but in other areas we're lagging in terms of government investment. But I just want to point out that Natalia also suggested an approach namely that we specifically say, look, there's a distinction between investment in domestic research, which is fine, and the domestic, and China's investment in its human capital, which is not only fine but a good thing for the world, versus subsidizing exports. Now, of course, in practice, it's not always easy to completely disentangle the two, but we should just be very clear that the first is okay, and the second we won't tolerate. And in order to credibly show that we won't tolerate it, we might have to take some trade actions that are, that if they were just standing by themselves, they would be bad. But in a bargaining situation where we're trying to affect long-run behavior, they might make a lot of sense. For instance, if it were possible for us to credibly convince the Chinese that we're not going to import, we're not going to allow the import of electric vehicles from China if the development of that industry is so distorted by subsidies, that would be a big step forward, because that global market is really important for them. That's the motivation for that industry. Now, it's not easy to do, especially not easy to do with the inconsistencies of policy in the Trump administration. But I think we can at least see a path there.
Yeah, also, I mean, of course, export subsidies are illegal under WTO, but also I think the Chinese realize that that doesn't work, because when we see these pure export subsidies, like directly to these special economic zones, then you create a lot of exporters, what is called processing trade, that is very low skill. So if the goal is to kind of have to increase technology and R&D, well, even from that point of view, might not be the way to go, because then you are not creating the right exporters, if you wish.
Yeah, I think they have switched away from that to more industrial policies that try to subsidize national champions, which either get their technologies from overseas or develop it within China, and just give kind of large-scale financial subsidies, low-interest loans that get rolled over. So I agree. I think that China is switching away from that. But Barry isn't. We mentioned this in the earlier conversation. So the Chinese government, you know, knows that there's this negotiation process that's going on, and you know, is playing along. But as you pointed out in earlier conversation, China has also, in the past, has offered a lucrative off-ramp to end the tension while still maintaining their strategic advantage, right? So, for example, one thing I can imagine China doing this time is to say that, fine, you know, if you want bilateral trade deficit to reduce, we can make that happen. We'll just buy an extra, you know, $30 billion worth of U.S. soybeans, but we still want you to transfer technologies to us. You know, we don't change that part, but we will give the non-strategic part of the negotiation to you. In that case, you know, how should the U.S. respond to that?
Well, we should. It's clear from the premise of your question, right? We should not get distracted from what our genuine interests are and what our subsidiary points are. I mean, we, of course, for the United States, we have a problem, which is that the president seems to genuinely believe, he clearly genuinely believes, that bilateral trade deficits are a bad thing and should be reduced. And unfortunately, although we will all certainly agree that that's misguided, there's probably enough of his electoral base who can understand that and sees it that way. I understand there's a poll, I haven't seen it myself, that says 66% of Americans support imposing tariffs on China for whatever reason. It's not clear, right? And so we have divided goals, because I think the U.S. trade representative and the people who wrote the report you referred to clearly see China's industrial policies as being the big problem, the most important problem. And they're not that worried about bilateral trade deficits for obvious reasons. And so China's response to all this has been textbook negotiating strategy, right? When the U.S. threatens, Chinese threaten back, tit for tat. There's lots of work that says that's the optimal strategy. Then after a pause, China offers an off-ramp. They say, oh, well, would you be satisfied, just as you said, will you be satisfied with these certain measures that would have a modest impact on the bilateral trade deficit? Because that allows them to not concede anything that they really care about and see if there's a way to de-escalate the situation. And we still don't know. It'll probably work, I think, to be honest. But we'll see.
Any last minute, Natalia?
I mean, I think like countries, I mean, should be alone on this, on their policies. I mean, within the international treaties they signed. So, I mean, if China decides to have industrial policy, good or bad for them, is their choice. The U.S. needs to think, like, what is the strategic or geopolitical, I think it's beyond economics, position in the world to answer to that, the emergence of this tech giant, or think, like, I don't know, 30 years from now. That's another story. Maybe you can do another podcast. I think, like, how you tackle that and your response to this geopolitical change is, like, it's what's coming now. Everybody will need to
so it's discussing. Beyond just trade, right? So this
I think it's much.
If we
focus on industrial policies, especially, I mean, you cannot tell a country not to do in their territory an industrial policy, right?
Right.
And especially if it does, I mean, it might violate some treaties. That's why countries might respond. But
yeah. So it is a domestic policy with big impact internationally.
Because it's a very big country. So yeah. Anything they do will have an impact, right?
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, thank you both. I learned a lot, and hopefully all of you did also. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to China 21, the podcast of the 21st Century China Center at UC San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. Visit china.ucsd.edu and connect with us on social media. 谢谢大家.